Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 6,000 members worldwide. For more information, go to our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 11th of April, 2026, and we are at episode 380. We're a bit delayed this month. Various things have delayed getting our regular podcast out. But in today's podcast, I talked to Lyndon McIntyre about his book on Sir Hugh Tudor and his controversial role in Ireland during the Irish War of Independence. Lyndon joined me from his home in Canada. Lyndon, welcome to the podcast. Now, to begin with, what first led you to look at Sir Hugh Tudor as a subject? And how did you come to realise that his story needed a thorough re-examination?
I came across an academic paper about this, about a conference between Winston Churchill and the President of the United States in 1941. And the conference happened off the coast of Newfoundland. Britain and the Allies were losing the war at that point in August of 41. The Americans weren't in it yet. So it was a kind of a summit conference between Churchill and the Americans on a battleship. So the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Great Britain leading this global war effort in the midst of a conference that also involved the what if we survived this war and what are we going to do after the war to create some kind of an international framework to prevent it from happening again. And they produced something at that meeting called the Atlantic Charter, which led to the creation of the United Nations. In the middle of all this high level stuff, Churchill says to his party, by the way, I have an old friend here in Newfoundland, and I'd like to get together with him. Well, could you get in touch with him in St. John's and bring him over for lunch? And first of all, I'm asking myself, I find this was in an academic paper, and the footnote said the friend was Major General Sir Hugh Tudor, who had been a friend of Churchill's since India, back in the 1800s. So I said, well, that's some kind of friendship. I mean, in the middle of an international conflagration, he wants to have lunch with his old friend and talk old war stories. And so I started to look into who was this Tudor and what was this friendship that has survived many, many decades and now sort of was still ripe enough to interfere with a globally significant conference. And so it turns out that Hugh Tudor was a very distinguished British Army officer who had a stellar role in the First World War, had a lot to do with Churchill over the years, and who, when Churchill needed somebody to run the British effort in Ireland to suppress an insurrection and save the British Empire, first person that came to his mind was Hugh Tudor. And Hugh Tudor agreed, okay, I'll take this on. So that's basically how it came to my attention, because I mean, like most people who have any interest in British history or Irish history, we've all heard of the Irish rebellions, we've all heard of the Irish War of Independence, we've all heard about the Black and Tans. And Tudor, as the little bit that I was able to find out biographically, was the commander of the Black and Tans in Ireland during the War of Independence. So suddenly, I'm an old journalist, many years telling war stories and the like, the itch started. I got to know more about this man. And it eventually, after a struggle, it became a book.
As all the best books do. Now, for listeners unfamiliar with Sir Hugh Tudor, who was he and how was a First World War general, as you've intimated, find himself in post-First World War Ireland, which is in the middle of what many describe as the Irish Revolution? Why is he there?
First of all, okay, who he was? He wasn't related to Henry VIII, his last name notwithstanding. He came from a modest Welsh background. His dad was an Anglican clergyman. His family history was in religion and business. And as many young people, young men of the late 19th century and before, notice that if you want to break out of your modest class, your modest social roots, one pathway is through the British Army or Navy, but mostly the British Army. So he, at the age of 17, he enrolled in a military academy in Woolwich and became a young officer. First assignment was in India, where he met another aspiring young British military officer by the name of Winston Churchill. The two of them shared a great interest in sports. They were both ardent horsemen and polo players. Tudor was a boxer of some success. He won a British Army title twice in the 1890s. And this, Churchill was an extremely competitive man with a fondness for violence and violent sports and conflict. And I think this aspect of Tudor, that he was a career soldier and a boxer and a horseman and a competitive polo player, I think this really attracted his him to Tudor. Tudor, on the other hand, was a young, modest guy out of nowhere in Wales, hanging around with this historically significant man whose ancestry went all the way back through British history with great glory. And he's suddenly like he's being touched by this association. And the two of them became very close. They reconnected during the Boer War, but most significantly during the First World War. Churchill, as followers of history will know, ran into a scandal as a member of the Asquith War Cabinet in the First World War, and had to leave politics. He for complicated reasons, but he left politics, but he didn't leave Parliament, and he didn't leave the war. He was an officer in the British Army regiment, and so he joined his regiment, put on his uniform, and he went to the Western Front as a battalion commander with the rank of lieutenant colonel. So he ended up in the same infantry division, the same army division in which General Tudor was now a brigadier general, and he was in charge of all the artillery in the division. The two of them just hit it off. Churchill was only there for a few months, but during that time they got together quite frequently. And then Churchill returned to politics and to the cabinet as Minister of Munitions. So he had an excuse to be back and forth to the Western Front frequently and always touched base with Tudor and always persuaded Tudor to take him as close as possible to the shooting and the artillery and the noise of war, and Tudor obliged. So during this period, they talked a lot. I have a compilation of diaries that Tudor kept in the First World War, and in it he talks a lot about the gathering, the dinners he had, and the drinks he had with Churchill out there. Churchill was describing to him his vision for a new machine that was going to transform warfare. It turned out to be the tank, as we know it. But he was describing it to Tudor out on the Western Front before anybody had ever really tried it out. Tudor had this notion that the conventional form of attack in trench warfare, where the soldiers came rising out of the trenches and ran across a very perilous patch of ground, behind an artillery barrage, which was supposed to limit their exposure, Tudor had a bright idea that the artillery barrage should include shells that created only smoke, so that the no man's land, the battlefield, would be completely shrouded in smoke. The soldiers could come through the smoke and surprise the enemy. Sure enough, Churchill goes back to politics, goes back into the cabinet, now led by David Lloyd George. And before you know it, tanks are part of the battle plan and smoke on the battlefield. So it was this kind of a friendship that had, that sort of made them even closer. And so when the war was over, Churchill by now is Minister of War, and the most pressing problem that he has is an insurrection in Ireland. It has been going on for centuries. It is now gaining traction because of the way, for many reasons, but particularly the way the British handled the Irish uprising in 1916. The brutality is on the rise. The count on both sides. The British Army has begun recruiting hardened war veterans of the First World War from the British Army to load over to put into the Irish police force. And simultaneously, the British government has decided we'll put the Irish police in charge of suppressing this uprising instead of turning the British army loose on them. A lot of reasons for that. But anyway, the Irish police are being transformed into a paramilitary outfit armed with weapons of war. There were so many recruits from England and Scotland swarming in, and that there weren't enough uniforms to keep them all identifiable. So they came up with a kind of a hybrid uniform of police and army, which was black and tan. And of course, the new people were called black and tan. Coming on to the mid of the late spring 1920, the situation is just getting worse. All the British recruits, the black and tans, seem to be making the situation worse. The Irish are getting more and more public sympathy, the IRA, and it's becoming stronger, and the political wing, Sinn Féin, is becoming pretty influential. So Churchill needs, we need a new leadership. And so he brings in Hugh Tudor, his old friend from India, Boer War, or First World War, and he says, I want you to take command of the Royal Irish Constabulary and put this thing right as quickly as possible. And Tudor agreed. Now, it's my personal opinion. Churchill came up with the name of Tudor out of nowhere by, you know, when in conversations in the cabinet in mid-May of 1920. And by the end of May, Tudor is installed with a team of former British officers around him to launch a counter offensive against the IRA. By the first week in June, he's been on the job about 3 weeks. He's in London having dinner with Lloyd George, Prime Minister, and Lloyd George, Tudor, and one other person having dinner and talking about the strategy. And the strategy is brutal. The strategy is going to require not just weaponry and machinery. It's going to require legislative cover. And the next day in cabinet, Lloyd George is introducing the notion, we're going to play hardball now, and we're going to create a legislative framework that we can do that without political consequences. And Tudor goes back to Ireland, and by then it's as we say, down and dirty on the ground, and it just got worse and worse.
And we'll come on to that in due course. Now, your book describes a man, Tudor, who'd never actually been to Ireland and seemed, if indifferent or maybe hostile to, I suppose, Irish aspirations for self-determination. How did Tudor's background, career and personality shape the way he approached this conflict and this volatile situation in the island of Ireland?
I think if he had a greater knowledge of Irish and British history and the history of the relationship between the two, he would not have taken the job. If he had any brains at all, he would have turned his job down. His only knowledge of Ireland basically was on two extremes. One, he served with a lot of Irish-born military officers, most of them from the north. Sir Henry Wilson was from Longford in central Ireland, but an Ulsterman at heart. There were a couple of brothers, Smythe brothers, that were from Northern Ireland, extremely effective war heroes, and he had them on his team. He had a team of Irish of warriors with Irish connections. As far as Irish politics were concerned, he had commented to friends, I don't give a hoop in hell for Irish politics. I don't care about that. He hoped he was offended by the Irish uprising, the Easter Rising in 1916. he blamed it all on Roger Casement, who he considered a traitor. In his diary, he says, "I hope they hang Casement." And of course, they did eventually. He went to Ireland, I think, with a notion that he was, you know, with his background in the military, he's up against a bunch of citizens in Ireland, ragtag fanatics, with no particular skill in the field of military field. This isn't going to take long. He learned very quickly after he got there that he's into a whole new realm of conflict here. Citizen-driven liberation movements are fairly new to the world, and tactics are being tried out in Ireland that will influence liberation movements all over the world for the rest of the century. But he couldn't know that. He knew he would quickly find out there are special challenges in fighting an enemy who is not wearing a uniform. Special challenges in fighting an enemy that is not part of historical military culture, where you follow certain rules and certain protocols, and that it's only in rare circumstances that discipline is thrown out the window and things get crazy. And of course, you learn from those moments that discipline must be maintained at all costs. So he goes in there with a completely unrealistic notion of what his job is and what the battlefield is. And very quickly, he learns hard lessons. Very quickly, some of these, the star British officer that he brought in to work with him was assassinated within a few weeks, just because of comments he had made in public that gave away the game that the British were planning to play, which is, we're going to fight fire with fire, and we're going to assassinate, we're going to terrorize every chance we got. And that got in the media. And the officer was murdered. His brother came over to avenge him, and he was another distinguished British officer. He came over to avenge him, and he was swiftly murdered. All these army veterans who were supposed to be gifted in combat and disciplined are running loose now in Ireland, creating havoc everywhere they go. They don't like the Irish. They have no respect for the place. They're driving around in small towns and villages and out in the countryside, shooting their guns randomly at nothing and at everybody. And they're having a terrible impact on public opinion, not just in Ireland, but around the world. So during the course of 1920, this solution that Churchill and Lloyd George have would put a seasoned military man. I mean, Tudor was a brilliant conventional military officer. He was mentioned in dispatches, I think, 10 times. He had been promoted in the field from a major captain, finally a major general and divisional commander, who was the youngest divisional commander in the British Army. He had a great career. He was getting herograms from the Prime Minister and from the leader of the British Expeditionary Force while the fighting was still going on. And at the end of the war, his star was high in the sky. And within a few months in Ireland, he's up against something that will turn him into an entirely different human being, and that will completely transform the Irish War of Independence into a liberation struggle that he does not understand. And the key fact that he did not understand was that Lloyd George and Churchill sent him in there not to defeat the IRA, not to sort of win a war, but to terrorize an enemy to the point where the enemy was prepared to sit down and talk reasonably and to come to an agreement that would be considered to be reasonable, but would be basically to the advantage of the British Empire. That was Tudor's unwritten assignment. That was the job that he accomplished. But in the course of it all, he destroyed his own life. He would never again be the Hugh Tudor that went off with the Union Jack flying over his head for the First World War.
You talked about Tudor's and Churchill's relationship and their origins of that relationship. What do we know about their sort of views on empire and their imperial convictions? And did these influence Tudor once he was appointed to lead the Royal Irish Constabulary?
Well, I don't think he had an ideology per se, and I don't think that he had a large political sophistication. He was a product of Imperial Great Britain. he was a product of the United Kingdom. He was a product of this vision that survived into my own time in school in Canada. You know, the sun never sets on the British Empire. The British Empire is a blessing to humanity, to human civilization, that has transformed human civilization into this remarkable set of institutions that we now have. I mean, it was the propaganda, and it was the belief that people who learned about Britain and the British Empire and British colonialism, that we absorbed from the earliest days of education in any part of the British Commonwealth or the British Empire. So he goes over there and he's full of that spirit. He has no sense of the moral struggles for self-determination that are starting to go on in a world that was becoming a different place after the end of the First World War, where all the great empires had fallen apart. With the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the collapse of Austrian Empire and the rise of the German Empire, it could be easily overlooked that the British Empire had its own fault lines and its own perils facing it. You could see, I mean, the British Empire could be perceived by people of British sympathy as an island of logic and or good order and democracies, small democracies and humanism, in the midst of all this uncivilized Turkish sort of European imperialism, and it had to be saved at all costs. So this was the kind of bias, the kind of prejudice that General Tudor brought to Ireland. He couldn't figure out, what are these Irish people complaining about? This is not India. It's not Africa. This is Ireland. Look at them. They look like us. They sound like us. They're funny, smart, witty people. They're artists and poets and writers, and they got a culture. And like, what's their problem? Why are they against us? And he just didn't get it, that they had been against us, you know, for like hundreds of years, for the simple reason that every so often when things went wrong, the Irish took the wrong end of the stick. And every so often when the Irish actually stood up and said, well, we want this and that, and we want to be able to play our own, run our own country, the British would sort of treat them with great patronizing ruthlessness. And then when it came down to the bottom line, they would shoot them and hang them. And so the Irish decided for once and for all, we're going to get our own independence. And the British were not in total denial. They said, well, you're sure. Okay, we'll give you some independence, but not everybody in Ireland is on the same side. There's a large part of Ireland that does not want an independence that's dominated by a bunch of Catholic Republicans in the South. And this was a considerable part of the population. So Britain is trying to now negotiate a solution to this problem that will give both sides what they want. And increasingly, the radicalization of the southern part of Ireland, the Republican side, became increasingly more vocal, to the point where it's going to be one Ireland, it's going to be a republic, and we're going to run it, and you guys are going to get out. And the British, by this point, knew that if that happens, there's going to be a civil war in Ireland between the north and the south, and we can't have that. Going to look bad internationally. We can't manage our own affairs in our own island and our own neighboring Ireland. So the stakes were very high. And Tudor did the job for them, in the sense that he and his Royal Irish Constabulary and his Black and Tans and his auxiliary troops, his paramilitary fighters, they hammered the Irish to the point where a large number of the Irish Republicans decided, okay, we're going to talk now. Anyway, so they agreed to sit down in a big room with some of the most seasoned, experienced, shrewdest negotiators, diplomats, and politicians on the planet. And here are a bunch of fellows, smart men, dedicated men, know very little political experience, virtually no international diplomatic experience. No, their only their gifts in tactics was on the streets, with guns in their hands, and now they're in a room in London, talking to some of the most sophisticated negotiators in the world, and they came away with a treaty that they most of them accepted reluctantly, but realized this is the best we're going to get, and they went home. And the British stepped back and said, "You take that, or we'll completely wipe you out." And at the end of the day, they forced this treaty on the population of Ireland, and it resulted in a civil war that the British generously contributed to by arming the side that they liked the best, the pro-treaty side, with the weapons. It was an even bloodier confrontation than the one that happened along the way that General Tudor managed. So it was an outcome that was going to leave everybody more or less miserable, except, of course, Lloyd George and Churchill, who managed to see their outcome as a victory for Britain and the world. The Irish, for the rest of the century, seethed, struggled to make a country of the place, and as we saw in the last few decades of the 20th century, it didn't quite work out the way that it was supposed to work out back in 1922.
You describe Tudor in your book as an accidental villain, and I wonder whether he was more of a deliberate architect of repression. How did you interpret his motivations and the extent to which he understood the consequences of the policies that he followed and enforced?
I think that by the time the consequences were obvious to him, he had moved well past the point where he might have been influenced by good intentions. I struggled with that title, the accidental villain, and I arrived at a certain comfort level with the word accidental. You're not the first person in Northern Ireland to ask about this. What my notion is this, that if you are going to attribute moral quality to any behavior, you're going to have to look at the motivation behind it. What was Tudor's motivation in the behavior that he exhibited, the violence that he fostered in Ireland? What was the motivation? Well, started out, he went over there to basically save the world from the collapse of the British Empire. He went over there because his entire formation as a military person was to always fight on the side of the right side, and always to fight with the full support the population behind him, and to win. This was not an unreasonable motivation to go into what he saw as a civil disorder that could be sorted out with a firm hand. And so he went in there, I think, presuming that, as was the case in the First World War, he would come out a hero of another experience, and that he ran into a set of circumstances that created a whole different outcome for the Irish and for him. I believe that he slowly and incrementally became the person that had to flee for his life by the end of his time in Ireland. It was an incremental accumulation of wrongdoing, bad judgment, cruelty, ruthlessness, and in the end, bigotry. So I would say that he did not. If he had gone in there with a battle plan to murder and to burn down villages, to terrorize people, to implement reprisals that disgusted the whole world, if he went in there with that in his mind, I think then I wouldn't have called him accidental. But the villains, in my view, were Lloyd George and Winston Churchill. They knew where this was going, and they knew what the outcome was going to be, and that he was going to be their cover for all this. He would be the firewall between them and the opinion of the civilized world that would look on Ireland as a sort of a degenerated brutality. And that Tudor would be the person, and the so-called black and tans would be the people that would explain, for the satisfaction of anybody who cared, that this was a crazy operation on the ground, that British politics, that it was out of the control of British politics because of these lunatics like Hugh Tudor and the Black and Tans. And so he became the villain of convenience for history, and he knew it, and he knew that there was nothing he could do about it. Churchill attempted to save him from the kind of retribution that faced many of the British officers in the Irish War of Independence by sending him off to Palestine to sort of solve problems that were developing over there, which didn't work because Churchill sent him, but Churchill was part of a government that collapsed while he was there. So by 1923, for the first time in his life, General Tudor finds himself unemployed with no safe place in the world that he can go to. His family life has disintegrated. He is estranged from his wife and children, four children, young children, teenagers. He can't go home. Henry Wilson, the chief of the British Army, had been assassinated in Belgravia, of all places, on his doorstep. The Irish, the remnants of the Irish Republican Army were all over the place, taking their vengeance on enemies that they perceived. Tudor was high on their list. So when he did go to home to England, the only safe place that he found was in the British Army and Navy Club in the center of London. And he sort of holed up there safely for about a year. And then somewhere along the way, he and some of the people he was associated with there come up with a bright idea that there was one place in the world that the Irish wouldn't be able to get at. That was Newfoundland, essentially a rock in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean. It wasn't then a part of Canada. It was at that time a colony of Great Britain. It was somewhere between colony and dominion, and basically in charge of its own affairs under British supervision. And he went there. Now, I don't know if he realized how long he would have to stay there, but he ended up staying there for the rest of his life. This is the, I suppose it's a long way around to come back to accidental villain. Did he have any idea that his actions would have the consequences that he eventually had to live with? I don't think so. I thought he went in there as a British patriot, as an political idealist, with absolutely no understanding of the Irish political or cultural situation. And he dug himself a hole that he could never get out of for the rest of his life. And I think that's why I would call him accidental. And I don't ask anybody to say this, but if you read the book, you might come to recognize that, yeah, this was a horror story on a personal level for him that continued, and the consequences he paid were a lifetime of exile in a place that he had never considered in his entire life as actually a viable part of the world, a place that he only knew about because he had a battalion of Newfoundlanders in his division on the Western Front near the end of the war, and they were quite distinguished soldiers. And one of them, 17-year-old, he wasn't even old enough to be there, but he was a fighter who won the Victoria Cross under Tudor's leadership. But Tudor knew that in Newfoundland, he would be respected. And because of the isolated location, he'd be safer than anywhere else. And that's where he went.
So turning to the impact of his policies on the conflict itself, what political and military impact did the policies of retribution, murder, extortion have on the British presence and the British conflict in Ireland from 1919 to 1921?
It had consequences that I don't think the British government really factored in. Or if they did, they thought that the consequences would be worth the success of the outcome. The outcome was to bring the Irish into a negotiating room where the Irish would suffer their most serious defeat. I don't think that they realized that they were running such massive risks in the relationship with the United States, which was becoming increasingly important to the British. They didn't realize that uh, that that such a large part of British society, including the British clergy, would turn against him. That it didn't realize the kind of traction that this was going to give to a new political reality in Britain, which became the Labour Party. The Labour Party was making a great deal of political advantage out of the behavior of the old Line Party, the coalition of Tories and Liberals in Ireland. That the Labour Party was using that with great vigor. And establishing a sort of a moral political presence for themselves. The Archbishop of Canterbury lashed out at British policy in Ireland. So, I mean, it had a great deal of backlash for British politics. It probably contributed to the ultimate collapse of the Lloyd George Coalition, but not before the work was done. And it set in motion a whole conservative period for the British in British politics, and that survived until the 60s and the 70s, and sort of basically defined British policy in Northern Ireland when the trouble started there. In a larger field, the whole Irish conflict informed a number of similar independence struggles in different parts of the world, notably in India, where the Bengal was on the rise, in the Palestine, where the Zionist rebels were taking notes and copying Irish Republican tactics, and in Latin America. There is I believe it's true, a legend that a dishwasher in a hotel restaurant in Paris at the time of one of the stages of the Irish War of Independence, he commented to one of his fellow dishwashers that these people will never be these Irish will never be defeated, and he turned out to become Ho Chi Minh, leader of the North Vietnamese rising in Southeast Asia. So it had a ripple effect around the world. Unfortunately, the lessons that should remain more strongly don't seem to be evident. If you look at the way the British behaved in Northern Ireland in the 70s, 80s, 90s, if you look at the fact that there was a second Bloody Sunday, Bloody Sunday in 1920 was supposed to be like, it would never be anything like that happen again. Well, it happened again in Northern Ireland in the 70s. So the hunger strikes, they happened again in Northern Ireland. The brutal assassinations and murders and the terrorist attacks on civilians, these things happened again. And okay, that finally we got the message. But now we if you look at what's going on in the United States today, you know, the tactics that the government is using to control a civilian population, and there's nowhere near the problems in the United States that the British were facing in Ireland or anywhere else. Right? This is to control a British population by employing military tactics, military personnel, people dressed up in combat-ready uniforms and equipped with combat weapons, roaming around city streets. Civil organizations like organizations in charge with customs and border controls, drug interdiction. And these are being militarized in much the same way that the Royal Irish Constabulary was militarized more than 100 years ago. They're being militarized, they're being equipped with military gear, they're being given military assignments to stand by in civilian communities in case somebody does something wrong, and then jump them and suppress it quickly. These are lessons that should be informed by history, should be informed by what happened in Ireland back 100 years ago. And there's absolutely no evidence that these lessons have been learned anywhere. And in the same way, today you have the black and tans. Black and tans have become synonymous in history, where people do not know any of the context. but they have become synonymous with terror and ruthless suppression of legitimate political goals. And I would predict that anybody whose granddad or great granddad was associated in any way with the black and tans does not boast about it today. I would suspect that if we look down into the future, anybody whose grandfather was connected with, say, ICE, the ICE forces in rounding up immigrants in the United States, chasing down people who work in car washes and construction projects, looking for their papers, and if there's any doubt, you drag them away and they disappear. Someday, their grandchildren are going to be saying, I saw a documentary about 2025, and I saw a guy dressed up like a soldier. Were you involved in that, granddad? And nobody's going to be very proud of that period of time. It will have deep, deep flaws in the national psyche, wherever this happens, whether it's in the Middle East or in Europe or in the United States. There will be deep psychological trauma that will last for generations. So I would have hoped that experiences like the Irish experience that were on a conspicuous stage. This was in the center of Western Europe, actually, and eventually the media was all over this story. I mean, they were coming from around the world to report on atrocities, the burning of Cork, the incidents in Tralee in 1920-21. They were coming from everywhere, and it was being telegraphed around the world. The world learned very little of it, and Britain seemed to learn less. So this is, I think, it's the legacy of Hugh Tudor in Ireland. I think it's a legacy that he could not have foreseen. I think it's a legacy that he did not plan. It is a legacy based on knee-jerk responses and reactions to problems that were in front of him that he confronted without any particular sense of moral consequences and historical fallout. And that's why I guess at the end of the day, I said this is a story that's got to be written, largely because it hadn't been written. I mean, the Irish War had been written. Nobody had written about this one individual and how he got tangled up in it. The relationship, the personal relationship between him and Winston Churchill, which plucked him out of nowhere and put him down in a situation that would alter many, many lives for a very long time. Tudor was not proud of the time he spent in Ireland. He was afraid of the consequences. He hid for the rest of his life. He never recovered relationship with his own children. He became unknown. He became a footnote. And he spent his life essentially recovering from 22 months in Ireland. I think that's a cautionary tale to anybody who enters into sort of public service or military or police actions. They're faced with the prospect of getting involved in political repression.
And Tudor actually left no personal record for his 20 odd months in Ireland. How did you reconstruct his role, and why didn't he keep a diary when he kept a diary through the First World War that you've alluded to in your previous answers?
When I got the first inclination of who he was and what he did, well, this is a story. This will be because and it was the sort of it's now Canadian, but it's not at that time. It was a British. It was a local angle because of Newfoundland and the Newfoundland aspect of it hadn't been really talked about. So I was going to find out what he did for 40 years in Newfoundland and how he survived for 40 years in Newfoundland, and the rest was going to be easy. Who he was, what he did in Ireland. It would be, so I started looking for him in Irish history books. There's been 50 of them on my desk. And he's a footnote here and there. He never wrote a memoir. He wrote voluminous and detailed diaries in the First World War. He even kept diaries in the Boer War. He never kept a note on his experience in Ireland. So I began to look at, well, who was he? And I realized that because of the story, his personal story, it was a story he was not going to help in the telling. So it became a bit of an ordeal. The main part of it was conducted under the COVID restraints. So archives were limited and controlled and often closed. His libraries were the same. Travel was constricted. Eventually, I found treasure troves of old newspapers articles that in which he would occasionally, but he didn't make speeches. He avoided the spotlight, even in Newfoundland, where nobody really cared what he did in Ireland. He kept his head down, and he very rarely had anything to say to anybody. But he dropped a few hints here and there, and in one of the hints he dropped, he had a grandson. And I thought, well, I'm going to find him. And I did. An old gentleman living in England who had met his grandfather once when he was a very small boy, but knew very little about him other than the legends. But his mother had been a collector of whatever available information there was about her father. And so through that, I established some kind of a profile. I found an older woman in Newfoundland. She is alive today at the age of 103, but she had known him for decades. Her father had been his lawyer. And she, at the end of his life, she and a friend were the only people basically personally close to him. And they took care of him, and they arranged his funeral, and they arranged contact with the family. And when the family declined to have anything to do with his final disposition, these two women did. So she was still around and very, very protective of Tudor, which indicated to me that he didn't have a totally negative effect on people. She was very protective of him. She considered him a gentleman. And she knew him extremely better than anybody. And so she obviously had some sort of an arrangement with him where she wasn't going to talk about him. And she was she was a woman whose role in the war, everybody I think is aware of the Bletchley operation, where women were employed at collecting secret information and keeping it to themselves forever. Well, there was a Bletchley operation in the Eastern Canada, in Halifax and Newfoundland, and she was part of that. So she had this cultural, professional bent towards secrecy. And so she was exactly voluble. But from her, I got the sense of a man who had an incredible amount of personal dignity, if not arrogance. From his letters to Winston Churchill, he and Churchill kept up correspondence for both their lives. He betrays in letters to Churchill a streak of racism and bigotry that Churchill had to suppress a little bit because Churchill did not want to remain on the record associated with it. So Tudor would write a letter to Churchill commenting on world affairs as politics unfolded, and make these outrageous comments about race and politics. And Churchill in the response letter would have to sort of calm it down. Tudor was all in favor of seriously restricting immigration on the basis of color. And as they did in Australia, he pointed to Australia as an example of how society should be managed. And Churchill, of course, would like back away from that without being offensive. He would back away and say, "Yes, I agree. We must be very careful with our immigration policy, but we must not base immigration on the basis of people's color." And so he got that on the record. Whatever he thought himself, he got that on the record because he knew days would come when people would be reading this correspondence. Tudor didn't care, or he didn't have that certain sort of foresight. So, I mean, he was a hard man to pin down in terms of who he really was as a person. I stitched together the best portrait I could from what he did, how he reacted to the world around him, the impression he made on other people. And essentially some of the few documents that one can find based on his time as the police chief of Ireland, how the efforts he made, he was coming under a lot of pressure near the end of this struggle to enforce discipline in the Royal Irish Constabulary. But at the same time, behind the scenes, he was being told, just keep on doing what you're doing, but don't make it so messy. And he would send out these memos to the RIC, basically saying, look, if you're going to fire off your weapon, make sure you've got it pointed at the right person. None of this random shooting. You're killing ordinary civilians. I mean, we can't have that. Discipline must be maintained, but carry on. I'm behind you all the way. So, I mean, he was a complicated personality. I asked myself recently, I was just mulling, if he had made himself available for an interview somehow, what impression would I have come away with after talking to him? And I came away with the impression of a very strong character for whom I would have very, very limited affection and very limited respect, actually, because I would have hoped that the man would have a greater sense of the moral quality of his work, and he didn't. He just did a job out of a sense of duty, and a sense of loyalty to Winston Churchill, a sense of duty to an empire that had outlived its legitimacy in the world, and he had tunnel vision about what his duty was and what his responsibility was. The human consequences were outside of the realm of what he considered to be his response. We go back, was he an accidental villain? Or was he a creature of intent? And I said, no, I don't think he intended anything. I think he just intended doing his duty. We had a lot of that after World War II, following orders. But he wasn't really following orders either, because Lloyd George and Churchill were too cautious to ever give him an explicit order that would ever be traced back to them. It was always in winks and nods and slaps on the back and private dinners. You're doing great. You're doing a great service to the empire, and the empire is a great institution for humanity. So keep on keeping on.
And on that, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, Tom. Good to
That's
talk.
Great. You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Rusman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS 2195. Until next time.